Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Now, from our nation's capital, this is Bloomberg Sound On.
The White House yesterday finally said they will end these public health emergencies. The problem is the president said he's going to wait until May.
The Supreme Court's order gives Republicans in Congress plenty of time.
But what we shouldn't do is fuel continued chaos and confusion.
Bloomberg Sound On.
Politics, policy, and perspective
from D.C.'s top names.
The White House has already given him a win on this by saying they refuse to negotiate.
Well, for God's sake, what are we doing? This is the United States of America. We know better. We're so much brighter than that. And now we're going to prove it.
Bloomberg Sound On with Joe Matthew on Bloomberg Radio.
The White House prepares to end the COVID emergency, forcing big changes on our southern border. So what's the plan? Welcome to the fastest hour in politics as we explore the legal implications of this move with help from Ellen Gilmer of Bloomberg Government and David Beer, the head of immigration studies at the Cato Institute. The political implications with our panel, Bloomberg Politics contributors Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano here for the hour. President Biden will deliver his first official State of the Union address 1 week from tonight. We talk about crafting the message with Democratic strategist Jim Messina. And as Boeing rolls out the last 747 off the line today, new questions about how U.S. talks with China could unlock new business. We'll discuss it with Bloomberg's Guy Johnson, who's in Seattle with the CEO. There are more questions than answers surrounding the White House's plan that we told you about when it broke yesterday to end COVID emergency declarations on May 11th, the story you first heard about here. Especially when it comes to border policy, because it'll also mean the end of Title 42, right? That was the whole justification, was the COVID emergency. Title 42, the health policy that clamped down on border entries, expanded expulsion power at the border, and a policy that's been tied up in the courts, of course. Republicans in the House, though, are not waiting around. They're set to vote this week on ending the very same health emergency the White House says it's ending. The debate is already underway now. House Majority Leader Steve Scalise suggesting that they forced the White House's hand on this one.
And so as we put it out there, clearly it caused some dilemmas amongst Democrats who were putting pressure on the White House. And finally, because as the whip pointed out, we announced this last week, the White House yesterday finally said they will end these public health emergencies. The problem is the president said he's going to wait until May.
They want it to happen now. Not to suggest this legislation will even reach the president's desk, but it is still unclear either way. What happens to Title 42 if the COVID emergency declarations go away? Because the administration's efforts to end it have been blocked by two different courts, including the Supreme Court. So is it just as simple as rescinding this on the executive level or even on the legislative level? That's why we wanted to talk with a couple of experts, beginning with Bloomberg Government's Homeland Security reporter Ellen Gilmer, who's been deep in this. Ellen, I really appreciate your being here. Is there a clear answer to any of this, or is the White House about to find out?
I wouldn't say there's a clear answer, but what I will say is, you know, the White House says Title 42 will end when the public health emergency ends. That's because when Title 42 was invoked, the CDC has issued a series of orders invoking that public health authority to set restrictions at the border. And in the most recent of those orders, it explicitly says Title 42 will stay in place until the public health emergency ends or until the CDC director decides it's no longer necessary. Mm-hmm. So Republican AGs have already blocked the CDC director's decision previously that said it wasn't any longer necessary. But that other trigger of when the public health emergencies end, that remains in effect. So presumably that's what's going to happen. We'll see what happens in court.
So yes, we will. I guess the question is, without a public health declaration, is there any grounds left for Title 42? How could you uphold that policy if there is no COVID emergency?
Well, so Republicans are right when they say that Title 42 stems from a different statutory authority than the public health emergencies. So it's not impossible to have Title 42 without a public health emergency, but that is the way it's structured now. So that is the trigger that exists the way it's currently written.
Well, that's really important then. So how will that matter in the eyes of the court?
Oh, for sure. It will be a big issue that they debate. I think it will be probably difficult for Republican AGs to try to argue that this trigger doesn't exist. But at the same time, we've seen them be very successful in a lot of creative legal arguments. Yeah. So I wouldn't count them out.
Oh, boy. And just to be clear, Ellen, if the legislation that's being debated now by House Republicans somehow did pass, become law, that would be an immediate rescinding of the emergency declarations. There wouldn't be a further out date tied to it.
That's my understanding, and we'll have to see how that plays out.
Like the day they sign it, I presume. Great. Thank you so much, Ellen Gilmer. Huge help from Bloomberg government. And as you would expect, is we want to add to another voice here to this, because it's going to happen, whether it's on Steve Scalise's timetable, President Biden's, or I don't know, the Title 42 is going to go away at some point here. And we wanted to talk with David Beer, Associate Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute, about that. David, I'm brought back to September when this was first going to happen. Of course, this has been strung out by some court rulings here. When Secretary Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary, was asked about what's going to happen in the wake of this policy, is the administration ready? Here was his answer.
We started our planning last September, and we are leading the execution of a whole-of-government strategy which stands on six pillars to prepare for and manage the rise in non-citizen encounters.
Secretary Mayorkas in September. David, are you concerned about what will be left in the wake of Title 42? Is this administration prepared for that day?
Look, they're much more prepared than they were, right? They've already instituted this month a policy that says that at least for four of the major nationalities that are crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, they have the ability now to apply in their home countries to migrate legally to the United States under a discretionary authority known as parole. And after this policy was introduced, it has reduced the number of illegal crossings by about 90% for those four countries. So they have a strategy now in place to reduce migration at the border, and they just need to build on that success, and ultimately that will prove to be the most effective migration policy that they can institute.
Okay, and do they need money or manpower, or is that the same thing to expand on that?
Well, they have a lot of manpower, and they have a lot of money. It's just right now it's going to a lot of, you know, management at the border and, you know, passing people between agencies and sending people back to Mexico. If they can use that money instead to process people at legal ports of entry, allow people to purchase plane tickets, make sure that people are migrating in a lawful and orderly manner, that's going to be a much better use of resources, and it's going to cost the U.S. government far less than what it's expending right now to detain people and try to force them back to Mexico or to their home countries.
How about these tens of thousands who are supposedly standing across the border waiting for this headline on Title 42 to be lifted? Does that require a surge of Border Patrol, and you know that this is a temporary situation to work through this number that's grown since COVID, or is this the new reality?
Look, the administration, that is a sort of a separate situation from people who are in their home country thinking about coming to the U.S.-Mexico border. But the administration has rolled out a new platform that allows people to register for appointments at ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border to request asylum. And this platform can work. And people are waiting. They're not going to search the border if they have one of these appointments. Right now, the problem is because of Title 42, they've effectively capped the number of appointments. They can't just end Title 42 by, you know, this other maneuver. So if Title 42 goes away, they can allow people to apply at these ports of entry, schedule appointments, and really moderate the flow and make sure that they have the resources necessary to process people in a legal and orderly manner.
Sure. And that's, we're talking about legal requests for asylum. How about enforcing areas of the border where they're seeing illegal entry? This is obviously something that was not being stopped by Title 42, but we keep hearing that more resources are needed to help.
Well, you hear that a lot, but really the reality is that Title 42 has made the problem much worse, because when someone is trying to sneak into the country, they're not trying to seek asylum. The best thing that they can get out of being arrested is just being put on the other side of the border with no consequence, which is what Title 42 does. They're just putting people back in the position to try again and again and again, and we're seeing recidivism rates at 50% for Mexicans and Central Americans, who are 90% of the people subject to this Title 42 policy. And so really they need to adopt a new strategy and go back to what they were doing under the immigration laws of the United States, which impose stricter consequences for people who violate the law, mm-hmm. while at the same time opening up legal asylum opportunities for people who want to follow the law.
Sounds like you'd lift Title 42 tomorrow if it were up to you.
Pretty much, yeah. Okay. Almost immediately. You need to have processes in place, but they've actually created those now. So there's no reason to wait any longer.
David, thanks for joining us. He's the Associate Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute. David Beer with us on Bloomberg Sound On as we assemble our panel. This is not a new topic for Rick Davis, I can tell you, and we've certainly discussed it with Jeannie Shanzano. They make our signature panel, and curious to hear your thoughts, Rick, now that we've had a chance to digest this idea. It looks like it will happen. Nobody can really necessarily predict a path for the courts to block this again. And whether it's in a couple of weeks or a couple of months, Title 42 will be lifted. Has this extra time allowed the administration to better prepare?
Sure. No, I think that David just, you know, gave the best a summary of what is now currently on the books, right? I mean, before Title 42 was the wall, right? Mm, I mean,
that's right.
You know, illegal immigrants come across, they put them right back over. They come across again, they put them right back over. I mean, it just basically served as a wall. It didn't do anything to process those individuals. It didn't divide them into those seeking, you know, asylum versus those seeking to have an economic migration. And so there was just this constant, as he said, recidivism to, you know, keep trying to test the system. Now, you know, there is a process in place. It won't be perfect. It won't include everybody. Not everybody's going to, you know, get an appointment and process themselves the way they want to be. But it will, you know, it will effectively change some of the congestion at the border. It's none of it is a comprehensive plan, right? None of it is really. Yeah. Meant to wholesale change the way we deal with border immigration, which still needs to happen, but it does render Title 42 less important. I am amused that the Republicans in the House are so anxious to take credit for killing off the COVID emergency,
right.
When what they're really saying out of one side of the mouth is, oh, we can't ever let go of Title 42.
Yeah,
except
right.
We're all for getting rid of Title 42. So the talking points here are very strange.
I'm glad you pointed this out. Jeannie, it's incredible. You know, nobody wants to finish the sentence on either side of this argument, it seems like. You know, the White House would like everybody, it seems like, to keep wearing a mask and get vaccinated and be careful out there. Do what you can to get back to work. And Title 42, well, we're going to get rid of that now. Republicans, on the other hand, are being forced to say here that Title 42 needs to be lifted, right? Without a COVID emergency, why would you have it?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think this really took the wind out of the sails of the Republicans on this vote. You know, Rick is absolutely right, because what the Biden administration is doing now is accusing Republicans of violating their own party's support for Title 42. And also what they have done here is no longer is this vote about how much power does the president have during a sweeping emergency, or the executive branch more broadly, or the administration vis-a-vis COVID. Now it's just about timing. And of course, on the timing question, you've got OMB and many people saying it should be a phased approach. And that's what, you know, David is talking about. Give them time. They have time here to plan to deal with immigration. If Republicans persist, they not only take away Title 42, which they claim they support, but what they also do is they increase the number of people coming to the borders and they make the problem that much harder. So, you know, in no way does this vote now make a lot of sense for them, but it seems like they're going to go forward.
They are going to go forward. It's not going anywhere, right? This is another messaging bill here, Rick, but they are taking credit for forcing the White House on this. I was talking to a couple of people off the record about it. The suggestion was the White House had its own timing in mind, but does this feel like a coincidence to you?
It does feel like a coincidence to me, a planned coincidence.
Okay, fine.
You know, I think at some point in time the administration was going to do this, but I got the impression they walked out on a May announcement early in order to take advantage of the Republican activity.
Jeannie, I'm assuming that Joe Biden's got to say something about this and be very convincing in his choice of words next week at the State of the Union. How does he win back confidence on the issue of immigration?
Well, I think he points to what David was talking about, a 90% decrease in crossings in the four or from those four countries in which they have started this parole problem. Those are big numbers. If they can replicate that, if they can build on that success, that shows that they are, without the help of Republicans in Congress, is what Joe Biden will say, or Congress as a whole, it's not just Republicans, they have been able to make strides against all odds. So I think he's going to point to that, and I think he's going to say to Congress, please do your job. Give us sound, comprehensive immigration reform, which, of course, Congress has no shot of doing this year, but he'll say it anyways.
Half the room will stand up, Rick. how does he convince Americans that he's serious about this? Because Democrats obviously have not scored well on this issue in many regards, particularly when it comes to security at the border.
Well, I think it's exactly what you just referred to, Joe. I think he's got to take it to the American public. I mean, Congress is only going to act if they think it's popular. And no president in the last, you know, two or three terms has invested in educating the public around how to solve these problems, how to create options, how to improve our economy by having a guest worker program. None of these things have been really done. And so he needs to launch a campaign. The problem is he's doing that in the middle of an election cycle. And so, you know, it's probably not the best politics for
his re-election. It's 1 week from tonight. Rick and Jeannie have more ahead. This is Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Sound On with Joe Matthew on Bloomberg Radio.
An end of an era today in Everett, Washington, as Boeing rolled the last commercial 747 off the line. Can you get over that? The Queen of the Skies, as they call it, in production for 54 years. The image of innovation and luxury when the newsreels first ran in 1966.
plastic. The mostest of everything describes the new giant of commercial aviation, yes. The Jetliner 747.
The mostest of everything. Look, a lot of time has passed. Of course, air travel doesn't have quite the panache that it had then. But fast forward to 2023, the last jet rolls off the line today, at least commercial one. They still owe another or two to the president. You will get to that in a moment. The Air Force One contract. Guy Johnson, Bloomberg News anchor, was out there in Everett for the occasion today. Talked to Dave Calhoun. Fascinating conversation. The CEO of Boeing on this landmark day.
You know, leadership, particularly during that age in our country, that was built around big visions. Just big visions. We're going to build the biggest airplane. It's going to have four engines. We're going to wine and dine on it. We're going to change everything about aviation. And we're going to make those seats more affordable than they've ever been so that we have more people in the world connecting. So it's a, I just believe it's a tribute to that moment. And then it's a tribute to engineering, and engineering.
And then reopening the story now with an eye on China. A guy was smart to ask about the upcoming trip that Secretary of State Antony Blinken has to Beijing, and whether that could unlock not only new business, but get the planes that were already ordered in the sky.
I believe that one of the reasons that we've sort of stalled there for the last 3-4 years is because, yes, the MAX, but because of COVID and the lockdown. So now all of a sudden it's coming back fast. They need airplanes. First and foremost, we've got to get the airplanes they already own back in the air. We call that return to service. And then the second step is return to delivery, which are the airplanes that are on our tarmac waiting to be delivered to China. So then we try to move down that path. And then hopefully, we get a robust order pipeline in China as well.
Now, that's a big hopefully, of course, but it's a big deal. And it reminds us that when we talk about the affairs of the State Department here, you know, it's not always just national security, although there is an element of that here. And White House politics, there's a lot of business that is done when relations are working between nations. We assembled our panel once again, Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano. We're going to try to connect to Guy Johnson, who's on the West Coast and spent some time today. Well, of course, did that interview with Dave Calhoun at Boeing. And Rick, you know a bit about this as somebody who has straddled the worlds of politics and business. How important is this trip for Secretary Antony Blinken on not just a broader economic angle, but knowing the chip war that we're in right now? For instance, and trying to preserve businesses like this one is an awfully delicate balance.
Yeah, it's a very tough balance because they obviously have a huge agenda that not only includes those issues you described, but, you know, talking to China about the Russia situation in the Ukraine, nuclear weapons control. We have no kinds of agreements in place with China over nuclear weapons. Humanitarian issues, slave labor. I mean, the gambit. The most complex relationship in the entire world today is with U.S. and China. And at the same time, China is a major market for our products. Yeah. And the airlines, Boeing, is maybe one of the biggest examples of how tough it's been without that market lately, you know, throughout the COVID period.
How does the White House balance that, the human rights issues, the national security issues, Jeannie, without shutting down the relationship to the point where Boeing can't get back in the air in China?
Well, I think they're taking an important first step. I mean, Antony Blinken will be the first top U.S. diplomat to visit Beijing since 2018, and I think that speaks volumes. I don't think anybody expects that they're going to resolve anything on this trip, but he has said numerous times how important it is because the relationship has deteriorated so fast and so badly over the last several years. I mean, just yesterday we were talking about General Minihan saying that we could be at war with China in 2023. So it's really important, and Blinken has said this over and over again, to reestablish relationships and to keep the conversations going. And that's what Biden and Xi have tried to do. He's going to try to do it. And certainly part of that is, of course, businesses like Boeing. They need to sell the 737 in China. They want to do that. That's going to be a big market for them, and it should be. And that's going to be part and parcel of this conversation. But of course, high on the list is going to be what we're seeing over there vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine, which has been very, very troubling.
It takes two sides here, of course. You know, China needs airplanes. Rick, I know they're trying to create their own industry there again, and that's been a recurring story. But does that not temper Beijing's reaction to, for instance, a visit to Taiwan from a new speaker, McCarthy? They need to do business with someone.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, Joe. I mean, they need planes. They can't produce enough to satisfy their stratospheric demand for air travel, even domestically. Nevertheless, you know what they're doing overseas right now, and so they're kind of in a box. There aren't that many competitors who can put together a long haul flight option for them, and they're constrained by their own production capabilities and technology. And so Boeing is competitive in this field with them, and that's without any real push from the State Department. So having the State Department at least understand the needs of corporate America as it relates to China is a very important one. But then there's another topic, which is how much flight capacity do we want to give to China? Are they really going to be so competitive that that strategically works against us in the short run?
Well, I mean, look, if you go back to our conversation, to your point, Jeannie, yesterday, about a looming war in the eyes of at least one Air Force general in 2025, are we going to find ourselves with an administration that's blocking the sale of items like aircraft, much like they are now, computer chip equipment making? Where do they draw that line?
That's right. And the news yesterday about Huawei on top of that, I mean, it just keeps coming. And this is the very difficult balance and the very difficult dance that the administration has to try to make and do with China. And it has been a struggle, not just for the Biden administration, but for the Trump administration as well. I remember distinctly when the Biden administration was coming in, one of the things we kept asking was, how will they differentiate themselves on China? From some people's perspective, they haven't differentiated themselves quite enough. From other people's perspective, they have at least tried to reestablish more of a sense of conversation and relationship, which is what Blinken is doing there. But it is very tough. I mean, you know, Pelosi's trip, you just mentioned McCarthy talking about a trip coming up. These are all things which just exaggerate the conflict. And let's not forget, Joe Biden himself has made what could be described as, you know, verbal stumbles, if you will, on Taiwan. I think that's the best way to put it. And the administration repeatedly have to walk them back. I'm not so sure they were missteps at all on his part. I think he really believes that. And so this is where this is what Blinken is walking into. And you've got a whole host of U.S. businesses like Boeing who need to do business over there.
Keep all this in mind when you listen to the president next week at the State of the Union and the words he chooses. When he mentions competition, not conflict with China, this is all in the backdrop here. By the way, fascinating conversation. As the 747 goes away, Guy Johnson was asking Dave Calhoun, and apparently Guy is somewhere at very high altitude right now. He can't connect the call. What's going to replace, what's next here, and what's going to replace the 737? They're already working on it with NASA. Boeing is developing with NASA this new narrow-body jet that you're going to fly on at some point with a truss-based wing, right? Imagine the wing across the top of the jet with struts holding it up there. It allows them to put these massive engines underneath to take you further and arguably cheaper. Calhoun talked about it today.
So now we have to prove that it can be commercialized. And so, yes, we bought a couple of airplanes. We're going to set it up. And by 28, we hope to prove to ourselves that this kind of technology can come to the marketplace. This is how you get to big objectives like the 47 set for itself.
Exactly. Okay, that's the airplane, the truss wing demonstrator they're working on right now, the new narrow body jet that will supposedly change the industry. Rick, don't you want to fly on that thing?
Yeah, I certainly wanted to fly a little bit before I get on board. I mean, it's a really amazing looking diagram when you look
we'll
at it.
We'll test it first, don't worry.
Yeah, but you know, look, it's the era of sustainable aircraft, right? I mean, this thing had, you know, can save 30% of the fuel that we currently do for the same regions. So, you know, I think that's a really good development. And I'm so impressed that they're doing this project with NASA. NASA's back, baby. I mean, we're going to the moon. We're going to Mars. And now we got a transonic truss-braced airplane.
I'm all for this. This is the best. And autonomy, Jeannie. I didn't ask you about autonomy. I'm not sure how you feel about a self-driving car. We'll see how you feel about a self flying plane because they're working on all this stuff.
Yeah, I'm with Rick. Can it be safe? And then I'll do it. And
let them test it first. Yes.
Let them test it. Don't just throw me up there, Joe Matthew. I'd like it to be tested. But I am excited, and it is good for the environment as well. There's an environmental climate angle to this, which is important. That's and true. I love Guy's interview and the Incredibles reference. I just love that.
That's right.
It's such a worth listening to.
We'll let you know when he's back down to earth. Rick and Jeannie, stand by. We're going to talk to Jim Messina ahead about the State of the Union.
You're listening to Bloomberg Sound On with Joe Matthew on Bloomberg Radio.
President Biden has exactly 1 week to prepare for the State of the Union address, and he's been out there working on it, right? We heard again today on the visit to New York, West Side Rail Yard, where he paid a visit to the Gateway Tunnel Project, or at least part of it. This is the massive rail initiative being funded by the infrastructure law that the president says will help improve travel between New York and New Jersey.
It's the busiest corridor in the United States of America and one of the busiest in the world. And the problem, a problem anywhere along the line, means delays up and down the East Coast for folks trying to get to work, businesses trying to ship goods, travelers trying to get to see their families. And by the way, as a U.S. senator, I commuted for 36 years every single solitary day the Senate was in session. I traveled over 1,100,000 miles on Amtrak, and I can tell you where all the delays were.
Amtrak Joe in the flesh. You may even hear that very line a week from tonight. And as the administration crafts the message for next week, we get a behind-the-scenes view and some thoughts on what we might hear from Jim Messina, the CEO of the Messina Group and former deputy chief of staff of President Obama. He was campaign manager for President Obama's 2012 reelection. Jim, it's great to have you back here. Obviously a major and important moment for President Biden. You used to watch your boss go through draft after draft leading up to the speech. Does this thing finally get baked over the weekend, or when would we see or expect to see a final version?
No, it doesn't get baked, sadly. I mean, there's famous stories about rewriting the thing in the limo on the way to the Capitol. Obama was a little bit better than that. But, you know, this thing will be the most sliced and diced thing you've ever seen, Joe, and won't really get baked until the very last hours.
And that goes for this president as well. I get a sense that this is a staff that would like to see him have a little rehearsal time. Jim, I don't know your thoughts on that.
That is very true. And it's, you know, Biden is good in that way. He's going to take a bunch of time to work on this. That's why I think this roadshow they're doing this week, going to a bunch of different places, is good. It gets his head in the game. It's really important to do as we get ready. Because, you know, the State of the Union, Joe, is one of the only times where average voters pay attention and look at least the coverage, if not the speech, and say, what's this guy doing to make my life better? And it's one of those moments that White Houses just can't screw up.
How do you start drilling down? And I'm sure there's a work group on this, but you must start with 100 issues. What is the right number for a speech that doesn't drone on for too long, that actually captures people's attention? Is there a limit to what he can say?
Well, the most important thing is to have a theory of the case. Like, what are you trying to do? And at the end, and this is what I always said to Obama and Biden, is at the end, what is it that you want to get the average American to understand about what you're trying to do? And that ought to be the goal. Yeah. And then you ought to think about everything else from there. To your point, you know, there's like 6 months of lobbying from everyone in Washington and both parties trying to get stuff in the State of the Union. Because if it's in the State of the Union, it kind of has to happen, or at least has a better chance of happening. So the lobbying is ridiculous. One of my jobs in the White House was to kill stuff and make the speech shorter because I didn't want a long speech.
God bless you. I mean, that wouldn't that just be a mic drop for a president to come out there, do, say, 20 minutes and be done with it? It would be the most memorable State of the Union in modern history.
Oh, dude, both parties would give him a standing ovation and everyone right. would run to the TV cameras and the bars.
We can do this. I feel like we can do this. So you start drilling down and you've got the message. When you look at this president now and you know Joe Biden well, is this going to be more about, hey, you guys aren't going to believe what I got done in my first 2 years versus here's what we have coming in the year ahead with this new Republican majority in the House?
Both. The answer is both. One, you know, as they get ready for the reelect, and as you said, I ran Obama's reelect, average voters don't know a tenth of the things he got done.
Yeah.
And so they're going to use this as a way to remind people. And you see that in the roadshow. You showed the clip earlier, or played the clip earlier about the New York infrastructure stuff. Mm-hmm. He's really proud of that. They're going to push that all the time. But then the second thing they're going to do is try to set up the oncoming debt limit fight and set up their side of it and draw some lines, not in the sand, but at least on a paper, to say we're not going to go any further. And so those are going to be the two goals.
Who makes the decision on guests? Does the East Wing allow the West Wing to manage that? Who sits in the First Lady's box? And obviously it's got to coincide with the messages the president's sending from the speaker's rostrum.
Oh, boy, that's a very negotiated thing. And I went back and studied the history. Usually it's the West Wing that decides most of it, with the exception of you're always going to give the First Lady one spot or two spots for her signature items. Mm-hmm. So for Jill Biden, it'll probably be her education initiative she's working hard on. Yep. For Michelle Obama, it was the Let's Get Kids Moving thing. For Mrs. Trump, it was her education stuff. So, you know, they're going to do a little bit of that, but most of it is jerks like me calling the East Wing saying, here's the people that are going to sit with the First Lady.
And they love taking your call. Jim, I'd love to talk to you next week once we get our hands on the speech or see and hear it. You're always welcome here. Jim Messina, CEO of Messina Group, with us on Bloomberg Sound On. To the panel, as we anticipate coverage, and both Rick and Jeannie will be with us a week from tonight as we hear the first official and see first official State of the Union address from Joe Biden. Jeannie, it's a big job here, and he's testing it out in real time. That was the latest speech today in New York. How's he doing?
You know, I think he is doing okay. We're starting to see sort of the outlines of the State of the Union, but also importantly, the 2024 campaign, and this idea of America reborn seems to be where we are headed with Joe Biden on the campaign trail, if he does announce, as we expect he will. And, you know, he is doing, I think, what you'd expect a president going into their third and fourth year to do, which is to say, here is what I have done. You know, I had a lot in which I wanted to do. We accomplished more than anybody thought legislatively, and now I'm going to tell that, oh, and the other people are crazy and extremists. I mean, that's really what we're going to hear an awful lot about, I think, over this, not in the speech necessarily, but over the campaign in the next couple of years.
The optics are going to be real different, if only for Kevin McCarthy sitting behind him there, Rick. How does that adjust the president's posture?
Oh, I think that it's a little less comfortable having someone, you know, right behind your left shoulder, you know, that is the opposition, you know, in Congress. So it's much better when it was Pelosi, who was kind of like your cheerleader sitting back there. Go do it. Get it. You got it. But at the end of the day, he's going to be singular focused on the one thing that Jim Messina pointed out. And that is he's having a conversation with the American people. It is critically important that he's able to convey to the American people what is it that he wants his second half of his first term to look like, and has he made a case, if he wants to run for president, for his next term. And that's going to be the only audience he cares about. He will not care about the people in the room, you know, whether it's the military or the judges or the members of Congress. He's going to be caring about having a conversation with the American people.
He cares about who's in the living room. And of course, the Super Bowl of politics will have special coverage right here on Bloomberg. David Westin will be with us in Washington. Rick and Jeannie will be here. We'll be live from the House, bringing you an important address, as you would expect. George Santos next. This is Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Sound On with Joe Matthew on Bloomberg Radio.
Bloomberg Sound On is brought to you by Innovation Refunds. This is your daily reminder from Innovation Refunds. Your small to medium-sized business could be missing out on an opportunity to claim the Employee Retention Credit. Innovation Refunds has helped thousands of small and medium-sized businesses claim over $3 billion in ERC refunds. May be able to help yours too. Learn more at GetRefunds.com. So, George Santos does it all on his own. You hear this? He's not going to serve on the two committees that he was assigned to serve. Been lots of questions about this, why Kevin McCarthy would allow Santos to be seated, but not Swalwell, for instance, or Schiff. At least Stefanik let the cat out of the bag at a Republican leadership news briefing this morning.
We just got out of conference, and George has voluntarily removed himself from committees as he goes through this process. But ultimately, voters decide. And I'm very proud that in New York State, we flipped five districts to help deliver us the majority. And ultimately, voters make this decision about who they elect to Congress.
So a lot of questions about why, again. We know that George Santos met with Speaker McCarthy about this, but says that he made the decision on his own. I will remind you of the report recently. The Justice Department asked that the Federal Election Commission not pursue enforcement action against him as it continues a criminal investigation. But you know what happens next for George Santos, reporters, hallway, elevator. Here we go.
Are you confident that you will be cleared?
Yes, I am.
Why? Why are you confident?
I'm confident I'll be cleared because I have nothing to hide.
Your finances?
My questions will be answered to the appropriate people. The media is not judge and jury of anything. Sorry, guys.
Into the elevator. Thank you. Goodbye. That's more than we've heard him say, I think, in any particular single instance yet. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano are here. Was this some sort of a deal, an internal deal, so they could pull off the Swalwell Schiff expulsions from committees, Jeannie?
I don't know. You know, I'm going to believe George Santos voluntary. Yeah, right. It's like when they say either resign or we will fire you. This is more what this is sounding like. And it's hard to believe him. But, you know, I think the reality is, I mean, the latest Newsday Siena College poll, 71% of voters in his district or in New York say that he shouldn't have been assigned. 78 said they need him to resign. This has been an enormous distraction for the Republicans in that leadership. Mm-hmm. I mean, what other sort of freshman has this number of reporters following them around? And of course, the State of the Union can't wait to see him there because the camera will be focused on him. So this is a problem for Republicans. They need to tell him to voluntarily, in quotes, resign so he could stop messing up their leadership in the first few weeks of the 118th.
Is that what happened here, Rick? Did Kevin McCarthy say, look, you're killing me. You know, if you could do this on your own, it'd be a lot easier for me to take care of everything else in the next 2 years.
Oh, I'm sure that if those messages were given to him, they were done at a much lower level than the speaker. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that having him around in general is a bad thing. So get him off of those committees, especially the science committee. I mean, that is a joke. But the reality is I get that 70% of these people want him recalled and out of that district. But who are the 30% who think he is an effective member? I mean, I wish we could do a town hall with those guys. I'd love to meet them.
You know, I'm just guessing those must be the Dunkin' Donuts fans, Rick. I don't know what else to say.
Well, he does do Dunkin' Donuts well.
He does. If it were Rick's office, they'd be crispy. We've already been through this. Jeannie, how long until we hear about these investigations and what is really going on in his future?
I think if we're waiting for House ethics, that's going to take a very long time. We probably have it. Yeah, the FEC is probably going to be faster. You know, it's going to take a while. I think Republicans would really just like him to like sort of sit in the back quietly and then run somebody else in 2 years.
Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis make up our signature panel here on the fastest hour in politics. Many thanks to you both, as always, and we'll be back with a lot more to talk about tomorrow here. We do this every day live from Washington. I'm Joe Matthew. Great to spend time with you. If you showed up late, subscribe to the podcast. This is Bloomberg.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.